You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. The Human Genome Project, the huge effort to sequence all the genes in humans, then figure out how they work, is one of the highest profile big science projects of our time. And if you remember back to the year 2000, President Clinton, British Prime Minister Tony Blair, and the project's lead scientists announced the completion of a working draft of the genome sequence. How many research findings are announced with that kind of fanfare? Well, from the start, the project has made big promises, predicting that once genes were identified for diseases from cancer to cystic fibrosis to diabetes, gene-based medicines would be provided, target treatments, and gene therapy would correct the disease-causing genes. But so far, the project really hasn't delivered on these promises, at least on a widespread scale. We really don't have any gene therapies that are working on any people. This hour, we're going to talk about the Human Genome Project, what it has accomplished so far, and chart the progress it's made toward the goals of better treatments and cures. And we'll start out by focusing on a study that's published in today's issue of the journal Science. It's a quite interesting one because three research teams using two different strategies identified a gene linked to a disease called age-related macular degeneration. It's quite a common disease. You may know people with it. You may have it yourself. It's a leading cause of vision loss in the elderly. We're going to talk with a researcher first from one of the teams about the hunt for the gene, which could account for up to 50% of the risk of the disease, and how the Human Genome Project made this finding possible. So if you'd like to join in, our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Josephine Ho is an assistant professor of epidemiology and public health at Yale University in New Haven, Connecticut. She joins us by phone. Welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, how are you?
Can you hear me?
I very well. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, well.
Can you hear me now?
Very good.
So how was I correct in saying that 50% of all macular degeneration might be caused by this gene?
I would say approximately, yes. Fairly common of this variant.
Mm-hmm. If this is one gene for a complex disease, one that's caused by multiple genes and environmental factors, doesn't that make it really hard to find then?
In this case, this is actually the essence of our study. We really take advantage of this Human Genome Project information that we generate a ton, flood of data with huge amount of, information. And this is initial finding, and we're still, digging out through more genes, more environmental factors. Mm-hmm.
This was made possible, though, by the Human Genome Project.
Exactly.
Why did that make it possible? Because you had a giant database you could have looked through?
Right. So it has to go through a little bit of how we do the study. It involves many parts, and each part really relies heavily on the various information from the Human Genome Sequencing Project. Mm. So first of all, design of the study that we collect a very high resolution of DNA variants from the human genome between each person, and also and once we have the data, we really rely on the human genome information to narrow down this particular variant that is associated with the AMD.
What would be the goal here? Would the goal, if you could take this to its logical conclusion about the disease, would the goal be to repair the defective gene in people, or would it be to, find out what the gene does, and if it makes proteins, supply those proteins through medicine to give to people?
Right. Talking about, if we're only talking about this only gene, I think this is the first step towards really understanding the pathogenesis of this disease. So what will come out later, really the final goal certainly is for treating and prevention, but it's too early to tell at this moment. But we give, fairly good direction to for the following study.
Mm-hmm. What did your team do differently than from the other teams?
Right. First of all, we don't have any assumption to begin with. While the other two teams, they are zooming in the candidate region and find the mutation as we did. We genome-wide scan the whole every single chromosomes, every mm-hmm. single variant with high resolution, and we are using high the intensive computational methods to dig out the signals from the data set that we get. Mm-hmm. So it's different in the sense that we are generating a flood of data, and we are just in the process of digging out more information from the data set, too.
Thank you, Dr. Ho, for taking time to talk with us, and good luck to you.
Thank you.
Josephine Ho, Assistant Professor of Epidemiology and Public Health at the Yale University, New Haven. She joins us there by phone. We're gonna talk for the rest of the hour, continue our discussion about genetics and the human genome. I want to bring in my next guest, Stephen Dager, the T.S. Matney Professor of Environmental and Genetic Sciences and a professor in the Human Genetics Center at the University of Texas Health Science Center in Houston. He joins us today from member station KUHF in Houston. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
You're welcome. Also joining us is Huntington Willard, the director of the Institute for Genome Sciences and Policy at Duke University in Durham, North Carolina. He joins us today from the campus there. Welcome to the program, Dr. Willard.
Good afternoon.
Dr. Dager, Josephine Ho said that the Human Genome Project made it possible for them to find the gene of this age-related macular degeneration. Do you agree that that really did make it possible?
I think it made a huge difference. I don't think the studies, all three studies, could have been done and could have been accomplished in the short time frame involved if the Human Genome Project hadn't been completed. I think it's just one of many, many examples of how incredibly effective and useful the Genome Project has been.
Mm-hmm. So the Genome Project gives researchers all this information about the genome so we can identify disease genes. But then what? You know, it doesn't mean we have a cure for the disease. We haven't seen cures for the disease. Were we expecting too much, you know, from the Human Genome Project? Too soon?
This is Steve Dager.
Yeah.
I think perhaps that the answer to that question is yes, we were expecting too much. The Human Genome Project and all of the incredible amount of information which has been gathered as part of that project is a huge scientific accomplishment. It's a huge advance in biology and medicine. But it's turning out that humans are much more complicated than we originally thought. And yes, to be honest, there's a large gap from the basic science understanding to actually treating people.
Mm. Let's talk about what we focused on today, this gene for macular degeneration. Why can't we then, you know, take this? If we know what the gene is, why can't we make a drug for it that replaces the gene or, you know, makes the medicine, so to speak, that the gene would be making for itself? What's so difficult about that? Let me ask Huntington Willard.
Oh, would that it be that simple?
And but you know, it sounds almost like mechanics we're talking about here.
Well, and in a sense, you're right. And the only parenthetical phrase you didn't add was that it might take 10 to 20 years in any
particular disease.
Yes, to go down that path. I think you raised the question of whether there was too much hype or whether the project was oversold, and I think only in the sense that the public. Needed to be aware of the fact that the early gains from the Human Genome Project, much as the story we started off this afternoon with, the early gains were going to be just the low-hanging fruit, if you will, or the very first steps in what is going to be a marathon, not a sprint, to get to the finish line. Mm-hmm. But I think, to be fair, there are a number of cases in which the information from the Human Genome Project is already having a demonstrable impact, not only on the practice of medicine, which is what everyone focuses on, but on many, many other aspects of life. So the payoff in terms of was it worth taxpayers' dollars, yours, mine, and everyone else, I think that the answer to that question is most definitely yes. This has been, as Steve alluded to, a huge accomplishment in a relatively short period of time, and we will be harvesting the fruits of that accomplishment for many, many years to come.
Steve, do you agree?
I agree. The other subtlety here is that if you take these three studies as an example, unless you had actually burrowed into the methods, you might have missed the fact that the Human Genome Project was absolutely critical and instrumental in these accomplishments. Mm-hmm. So there are, I'm sure by now, thousands of publications and findings that have benefited materially from the Human Genome Project, but you just don't notice it. It's, in a sense, the same way we think about computers in our society. They're so integral to everything we do that we don't say that, gee, this computer made it possible for us to have this conversation today or any other major aspect of our society. The Genome Project is the same thing. It's now such a part of the world of medicine and biology that you virtually forget that it's the bedrock of what we do every day.
1-800-989-8255 is our number, 1-800-989-TALK. If you'd like to talk about the Human Genome Project. It seems like that the public is expecting to see results, though. You know, I mean,
I don't think we want to be too defensive about this. I do think scientists in general, both administrator scientists and practicing scientists, have to take a measure of blame for perhaps not being careful enough in explaining to the public at large, as who are after all partners in this enterprise, what the process of science discovery is all about, how long it actually takes, and what the smaller steps along the way are where there are proven benefits, and bring the public along as partners in what is going to take years and years and years before we finally get to the point where we can treat and cure diseases. Congress, however, in order to approve the funding of the Human Genome Project back in the late 1980s and 90s and early 90s, did have to be convinced that there was going to be a payoff, if you will, and the payoff is most typically expressed in terms of the impact this would have on healthcare. So I do think we have to be a little more careful on how we potentially oversell scientific advances, and yet at the same time bring the public along with a level of understanding, since they're, after all, this is not too fine a point. They are, after all, paying for it.
Why aren't well? Maybe they are, and I'll ask you: who is paying for it? I mean, you know, when drug companies want to make something for your cholesterol, they spend a lot of money. When they make something for your erectile dysfunction, they spend a lot of money. Are they spending a lot of money curing things like the macular degeneration? Are they looking for
I think there's no question that both in academic laboratories, supported in particular by the National Institutes of Health, as well as laboratories and pharmaceutical companies funded by private funds, there's an enormous amount of research that's going on. The NIH budget, the National Institutes of Health budget, is something of the order of $28 billion a year in research, only actually a small proportion of which is in what you or I might call human genome-related research. Mm-hmm. The pharmaceutical industry also spends at least that much money in this country and around the world. So I think there's enormous research focused both on individual diseases like macular degeneration and on disease processes, more general processes that might have application to multiple diseases.
1-800-989-8255 is the number. We're talking about the Human Genome Project this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. There does seem to be some concrete advances, a few advances, and many of them are coming in diseases in the animal world where the laboratories always start first and see if they work there, of course, in the laboratories. In particular, there's a study just out from Baylor College where rats were cured of an inherited liver disease with gene therapy. Researchers at the University of Pennsylvania used gene therapy to treat cats with a naturally occurring genetic disease. Don't studies like these suggest that gene therapy has some tread to it?
This is Steve Dager. Yeah. The answer is yes, absolutely. I have to return to my earlier point, though, that there are tremendous advances that have led directly to treatments in humans and in animals that come out of the Genome Project that you simply aren't aware of because they're so subtle. They're just part of the basement structure, let's say. Tell us about them. Well, for example, my area of research is in the genetic causes of an inherited eye disease called retinitis pigmentosa. Mm-hmm. Retinitis pigmentosa is a disease that may affect over 100,000 people in the United States. A very few people, not a substantial number, but real human beings have benefited already from knowing what the cause of their retinitis pigmentosa may be. Furthermore, there are a number of...
Continue. Okay. That's an interesting thought. Tell us more about how that
happened. That's going to turn out, I suspect, to be a general rule, but specifically as demonstrated by the disorder retinitis pigmentosa, there are many potential genetic contributions. We now suspect that there are dozens of different genes that can lead to that disease. Those genes are going to be being hammered away at one by one by one. We now can identify at least 50% of the genes that are involved in retinitis pigmentosa. As you do that process, as you hammer away one by one at the causes, you occasionally identify a cause and you look at the gene, you look at the protein produced at that, and you go, oh boy, I know what we can do about this. And there are a few examples of that. There are a few relatively rare forms of retinitis pigmentosa where treatments based on giving vitamin A analogs can actually slow the progression of the disease. But then you add to that, there are animal studies in which gene therapy absolutely has been successful in arresting retinitis pigmentosa and similar diseases. Those studies are going to move into human clinical trials within months. We know a number of companies that have developed both gene-specific and generic treatments for retinitis pigmentosa. Those therapies are going to move into clinical trials certainly in the year 2005. The problem is that each of these advances is so small taken alone that it may not make the front page of the newspaper very justifiably these have.
Well, why would you call that a small advance? I mean, why would anybody
if you're the five people in the United States who have the disease that's now treatable, that's not a small advance. That's a miracle. But let's face it, there are 300 million people in the United States, and it's hard to make a case about five.
But there's five today, and 50
tomorrow, and 5,000 10 years from now.
Right. And you have to have enough of a disease population for a pharmaceutical company to want to make a drug for it.
That's probably true, but many of these diseases fall into the orphan drug category, which gives financial and regulatory benefits to companies who wish to develop treatments.
Right.
Again, none of this is directly relevant to age-related macular degeneration because it's a very common disease, and there are a number of drug companies who have a very strong investment in research in that area.
Yeah, well, we can branch out. We're flexible, you know. We can branch out into other diseases this hour. So please bring them up. We're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we'll talk lots more about the Human Genome Project, and we'll learn, from these experts about other diseases that they're flying under the radar screen and slowly making successes that we haven't heard about. We'll try to put them back as a blip on the screen. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this short break. I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. We're talking this hour about the human genetics and the Human Genome Project on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow with my guests, Hunt Willard, Director of the Institute for Genome Sciences and Policy at Duke University in Durham, North Carolina, Steve Dager, the T.S. Matney Professor of Environmental and Genetic Sciences and Professor in the Human Genetics Center, University of Texas Health Sciences Center in Houston. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Andrea in, is it Grosse Isle, Michigan?
Yeah, Grosse Isle, Michigan, that's right.
Hi, go ahead.
I had a question. I understand how great it is that we're able to discover that some of these DNA sequences may lead to, you know, understanding what causes these genetic disorders. But I was wondering about the field of pharmacogenomics, about how that might potentially lead to the denial of someone's insurance companies or the termination of employment, knowing that this person might possess the possibility of receiving or having this genetic disorder.
Dr. Willard, good question.
Well, Andrea has touched on two very important points in pharmacogenetics, and one of them relates to the use of this to prevent what are now about 100,000 deaths in the country annually due to adverse drug responses, and the potential use of information from the Human Genome Project to identify variants in your genome or my genome that would have us either over-respond or under-respond to a given dose of a drug. That's a very important growing area where probably within the next very few years, I think we'll see tests introduced in order to allow better dosing for drugs in hospitals and in healthcare generally to allow us to have the right drug at the right dose for the right person. But she raises an important issue of privacy and non-discrimination, and I think many of the advances at the level of health policy are going to be held back until we have a national genetic non-discrimination act passed. As you may be aware, the U.S. Senate has passed that bill twice, both in this session of Congress and in the previous one. The House is yet to take action, didn't take action in the previous session, and has yet to take it up in this session. But hopefully that act will be passed, because that will then ensure that nobody can take advantage of information about the genetic variants that exist in your genome or my genome in order to deny coverage.
Do you know what committee that one is in?
It's actually in several committees. Yeah. It's three different committees, and that often is what slows down the process, but hopefully with a goal of getting a better bill at the end of that process.
Mm-hmm. My hope is that there is national legislation. It would, to be honest, make my own life easier, because we do genetic identification in individuals, and I am very concerned about the confidentiality of the information that we generate. And if there was some national or state protection of those individuals, I would be much happier with the information that we're producing.
Well, we're giving protection to the vaccine makers from being sued, aren't we? I mean, why can't we give protection to people's privacy?
Well, that's a good question. The Senate obviously accepted that concept. As I said, the House is wrestling with it. Not yet convinced, I believe, that in fact this is a genuine problem. On the other hand, if you talk to patients and even non-patients, healthy individuals around the country, there's a high level of anxiety on many people's part about the notion that their genetic information will become available to people and to a variety of people, and what they might do or not do based on that information.
Okay, Andrew.
So it is a problem.
Oh, that's great. Thank you very much.
Thank you for calling. Have a good weekend. 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Bobby in Boise.
Yes, hi. I have a question that maybe, I don't know if it's on topic or not, but I was curious if there was any impact on the restrictions for T-cell research, or stem cell research, I mean, on what you guys are doing as far as finding cures for different diseases.
Any crossover there?
For my research, specifically in the genetic causes of inherited eye diseases, as of today, the restrictions on stem cell research are not a burden. I can well expect, though, that in some future time they will be a burden if there's not some relaxation. At the same time I say this, there are partially changed stem cells that are in the retina that can be used that would circumvent the problem of using embryonic material. But I think this country, and for that matter the rest of the world, is going to have to carefully address how to use stem cells in a way which is both ethical but will actually advance treatments.
All right.
Yeah, I might answer the question in a slightly different way, in the sense that this is a terrific example, Bobby's question, of how the Human Genome Project has impacted health and science policy generally. Stem cells, like all of our cells, have their own copy of the human genome, and the whole research effort to decide how stem cells can potentially be used therapeutically, whether adult stem cells or embryonic stem cells, that involves understanding how the genome works and reshaping the genome to do the job that you wish it to do in a particular tissue or fighting a particular disease. But this is health and science policy at its best, and we're going to have to bridge between the science and policy arms of that debate in order to see how it impacts.
Thank you, Bobby, for calling. Is there a breakthrough or a tool or some sort of technique that, you know, you wish you had? You know, and I have the Science Friday limitless blank check question. If I had to give you a blank check for any amount of money and you could use it and overcome some sort of roadblock, is there something there that's keeping this from moving any faster?
I think, from my perspective, the answer is what is often referred to as the $1,000 genome. Right now, to sequence your genome, Ira, would probably cost, estimates vary, but anywhere from $500,000 to several million dollars to sequence your genome.
Mine's cheap. It's a lot of junk in there.
But there are... there's treasure a significant junk. Push, significant push at the technology development end to adopt new technologies to bring the cost of sequencing way down. And if we can evaluate a given individual's entire genome at the cost of $1,000 or maybe a few thousand dollars, that fundamentally changes the way we address disease in what we call genomic medicine, where you would bring people into the healthcare system, hopefully when they're absolutely as healthy as can be. Scan their genome, look at all of the variants that distinguish one copy of a human genome from another copy of the human genome, and look for the variants that might predispose to different types of disease, including the variant that has now been connected to age-related macular degeneration. If we could do that genome-wide for thousands and thousands of diseases, for literally everyone in the country that was entering the healthcare system, that would fundamentally change the way we provide healthcare in this country and around the world into a much more personalized form of healthcare, taking advantage of the tools of genomic medicine. So that's the dream, if we can use your dollars to find that breakthrough.
And what's, you know, is it just a finding a cheaper way of doing it, investing in the, you know, to look for the cheaper way, or just scaling it up so big that it becomes cheaper for each individual person?
How about all of the above? No one knows where it's coming from. We need more technical resources for rapid sequencing. I have to say, almost parenthetically, that Hunt and I didn't compare notes ahead of time, but I would have said exactly the same thing. Fast, quick DNA sequencing would help everybody in this profession. There are a number of very clever new technologies that are being developed in both universities and in the corporate world. Just having more flat-out resources for building the machines and putting them in laboratories would help. We need some brand new ideas on how to do this. But all of those things are happening. I would suspect that the $1,000 genome will certainly come about sometime in our lifetime.
Mm-hmm. And if you had it now, could you make use of it? If everybody had it now, is it too early in our science of genomics that you could really make use of it?
Well, suppose the honest answer is we could only make use of 1% of it, mm-hmm. that the remaining 99% would be a mystery. Still, that 1% would be a huge advance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree with that. There are something like 3 million DNA differences that distinguish my genome from Steve's or our genomes from any of the listeners. To be able to understand what even a few of those changes would portend in terms of which diseases we might be at risk for would allow the healthcare system to adapt on an individualized basis to guide people in their both their lifestyle and their interactions with the healthcare community. So if we could do even a fraction of it today, it would be a major advance.
Susie in Cincinnati. Hi, welcome to Science Friday. Only calling on people with alliterative names this hour.
I noticed that. I just have a little story. You're talking about the small things that can make big changes in people's lives. I have a friend I met about 10 years ago when he was in his early 20s with severe Crohn's disease. And he'd had surgery to have part of his bowels removed already, and they didn't expect him to live past 30. And I ran into him about a year ago, and he said thanks to some mouse genes that he's completely cured, no problems whatsoever.
Wow. So, did you find out any more than, you know? Well, that would have piqued my interest.
Yeah, I've tried to find out a little bit more, but haven't been able to get in touch with him lately without doing too much stuff.
Yeah. But he said a mouse gene saved him.
Yes. Huh. I'm assuming that was a genetic therapy where they inserted a mouse gene into his.
I wouldn't assume that.
Code.
Dr. Willard, would you assume that?
No, I don't think we would assume that either. I think it probably was a breakthrough that came from advances that were made by studying a mouse model of Crohn's disease. And that points up a very important aspect of not only human genome research, but all forms of biomedical research and using animal models and the contributions that they make to allowing us not only to understand the disease, but to develop both therapies and management protocols to best treat these diseases. But that sounds, in your case or in your friend's case, Susie, that's a tremendous example of the value of medical research and what it can mean in an individual's life.
Yeah, definitely. Susie, over 30 now and going strong.
Terrific.
Susie, this is Steve Dagher. I was at a meeting recently of individuals who are affected with retinal disease, and I sat in the back of the room as some presentations were made, and two women leaned over and talked to each other, and the one woman said, "They have a mouse for my disease." And I thought, wow, she really gets the concept. That's a very important breakthrough for that particular individual and that particular problem. So mouse genetics are turning out to have tremendous help in understanding human diseases.
Cool. That's great.
Thank you, Susie.
Thank you for taking
Thanks
my call.
Thanks for that story. Have a great weekend. So when you say we have a mouse for your disease, that means we have a mouse with the gene we've discovered that has the same disease you have?
More or less, there's all sorts of nuances to it, but I think that's fundamentally what we're saying. We might mean that the equivalent mouse gene has been altered in such a way that the effect in the mouse is the same as in a human. We might say that a human type of change has been introduced into that mouse and is now creating the human-like disease in the mouse. Mm-hmm. The bottom line on all this is that you now have a mouse in which you can try gene therapy, you can try drug therapies, you can try nutritional therapies.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. We're talking about the Human Genome Project this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. So when we hear them saying all the time, hey, we've got, you know, we've deciphered this genome, the mouse genome, the fly genome, the whatever, we should get excited about that because we might find something in there that helps us.
I think there's no question about that. I mean, what most people don't understand is that most of our genome had its origin hundreds of millions and in some cases a billion or more years ago, long before what we now recognize as, quote, humans, unquote, were walking this earth. We share much of our genome with many, many other organisms. And it's by studying those other organisms that we learn nature's secrets in both her successful experiments and her failed experiments in identifying exactly what genes carry out what functions, either by themselves or as a collection of genes. So each and every genome that gets sequenced, and there are now hundreds and hundreds of genomes that have been sequenced, each one of those has a strong argument behind it and is revealing all kinds of secrets that will help us understand the human genome.
There was a news story this week about companies that are making and marketing at-home genetic tests. Is this a good idea? You know, it's almost like a pregnancy test, but it will tell you, I guess, a lot more than that. I mean, should we have people? I mean, I'm sure this is going to be passé soon. I mean, soon meaning down the road sometime.
If a genetic test at
home. Go ahead, Steve.
If a genetic test at home, well, we can.
Alphonse, you go first.
Yeah. Right. A genetic test. If a genetic test at home means that I collect a blood sample or a sample of cells from my cheek and send it to a company where it's analyzed and then a very careful explanation of the results are provided to me, I'm all in favor of that. All you've done is just make it a little easier to avoid having to go to a lab. But if you mean literally by an in-home test that you see the result and you, as the individual who had the test done, have to figure it out, I think that's a disastrous situation because there are a great deal of complexities in understanding genetic results, and it really helps to talk to the people who have studied that problem in depth.
But you would think go ahead.
Well, I would agree. This is a concern over an area that's called direct-to-consumer marketing, and there are many groups, including an advisory committee for the Secretary of Human and Health Services of the federal government that are very concerned about direct-to-consumer marketing and essentially arguing that there needs to be a step that brings the health professional community into that debate because the public, even scientists, don't necessarily understand what each of these DNA variants means for us. And those results have to be carefully explained, the pros, the cons, areas of certainty and areas of uncertainty, before the public really would know how best to make use of genome information.
We've got only about a minute to go. Let's talk about, you know, some concrete examples, at least one. Let me talk about the retinitis pigmentosa or your other studies that you're involved with. Is the future now, at least in the immediate future, going to be these little drips and drabs, maybe discovering a protein that does something that, you know, maybe a vitamin or something like that, and then seeing if we can give a little bit of medication for that?
If you go back to retinitis pigmentosa as an example, everyone's looking for the Hail Mary pass that solves the problem in one fell swoop.
Right.
That's always a possibility, and there are some attempts to treat retinitis pigmentosa at a global level. On the other hand, we can see already that individual by individual, gene by gene, there's treatments coming online that will help a few individuals today, more individuals in the future. My personal prediction, taking retinitis pigmentosa as an example, is that there will be effective treatments for perhaps 1-2% of people by the end of this year. There will be effective treatments for perhaps 5-10% of people within 5 years and perhaps 90% of people within 10-20 years. So you're going to see this develop slowly, but as a crescendo coming online within the next couple decades.
And you think that would be the same template we would see with other things, possibly macular degeneration or something like that?
I think if we jump to the other end of the frequency spectrum and look at a disease like cancer, we may see breakthroughs that are much more widely applicable to the population at large, mm-hmm. where different approaches to disease diagnosis and management coming from the Human Genome Project are allowing large numbers of people to get the right therapy personalized to their particular form of cancer that they have. And that information is coming, that diagnostic information is coming from the Human Genome Project and studying different genes and how they're expressed.
Right. I've
read this isn't just the rare diseases, it's also the common ones.
Steve Dagher, University of Texas Health Sciences Center, Hunt DeWillard of Duke University, thank you for taking time to talk with us today.
My pleasure.
Thank you. Our program is produced by Ned Heist, Charles Berquist, and senior producer Karen Berghoff. Charles is our director, and our interns are Corey Binns and Todd Neal. And if you'd like to surf up to our website at sciencefriday.com, you can get free teaching materials we make on Science Friday. Just click on the Teachers button. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.